Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation, for the opportunity to present some of our results on the transition to turbulence in pipe flow. The people with whom I did this include a bunch of graduate students in Marburg, prominent among them Holger Feiss and Tobias Schneider, who's continuing this. There are some experimental results from the group of Franz Neustadt in Delft with Björn Hof and Kars van Dorne as the primary experimentalists there. Time permitting, towards the end, I will talk about recent work that I did with Joss Kafka and Jim York in Maryland on the boundary to the transition to turbulence, and there is also some helpful discussions with Jeff Mullis in Santa Barbara about the dynamics. One can ask sort of why turbulence, the transition to turbulence in pipe flow, is still an open problem. We have, for many other situations, a very clear understanding of how we can, at least in principle, understand the transition to some sort of turbulence. And this goes through a sequences of instabilities and bifurcations. We start out with a laminar profile, we increase some control parameter, we encounter a first bifurcation where the system develops some spatial or some temporal modulations, and then as we increase the control parameter further, we add more and more degrees of freedom until in the end it sort of looks spatially and temporally fluctuating, which is what we then call turbulence. And many in the audience have worked on the fluid heated from below, the Weyl-Lebesgue problem, and on the flow between rotating cylinders, the Taylor-Cuette problem. And this program has met with incredible success in those two cases. You can work out all the bifurcations, and there are lots of beautiful detailed aspects that can be studied and verified experimentally. So this is Landau, Rial, Tarkins, and all the others involved in that. Now, since I will need it later on, let me spend a minute on Taylor-Cuette. So you have a flow between two concentric cylinders, they can rotate independently, and this introduces then a whole bunch of parameters. The ones that are easiest to vary are the rotation rates of the inner and the outer cylinder, and then the one that is a bit more difficult to change is the aspect, the radius ratio of those two cylinders, because then you have to change your apparatus. So many of these experiments are done with a radius ratio of below 0.9, 0.8, 0.7, something like that, where the flow is dominated by the centrifugal instabilities that come from, say, inner cylinders rotating and outer one at rest that drives the fluid outwards. And if fluid goes outwards, some other fluid has to come back in, and then you get the Taylor vortices. Now, if you scan the parameter range, Reynolds number for the outer cylinder and for the inner cylinder this way, you encounter a whole bunch of instabilities. This is a famous diagram from Swinney's group from 78. And you see the various bifurcations, many of which have been studied sort of in considerable detail. The primary instability, if you have the outer one at rest and increase the speed of the inner cylinder, is the one to Taylor vortices. And that's what they look like. You have sort of fluid that goes from the inner cylinder to the outer cylinder and comes back. So it's transverse to the shearing induced by the mean profiles. This has an azimuthal symmetry around the cylinder. And if you then increase the rotation rate of the inner cylinder a bit further, somewhere here, you get into this regime of the wavy vortices. And then the bifurcation that happens is that you lose this azimuthal symmetry and you get into a flow. I hope that this, no, it doesn't. That has sort of a spatial modulation as you go around the cylinder. And then you go on from there and you have further and further bifurcations. Now, what happens in these experiments, if you increase the control parameters, you get very clear transitions. There is a critical slowing down at the point of bifurcation, but if you wait long enough, then you can clearly discern whether you have a pattern or not. And the critical Reynolds numbers, these lines here, are very well defined. If you go to pipe flow, many of these things change and are very different. The sort of best documented experiments go back to Osborne Reynolds in 1883. He was motivated by observations by Hagen and Poiseuille some 40 years earlier, who noticed that at very low flow speeds you have your Hagen-Poiseuille type behavior with flux proportional to pressure gradient and proportional to the fourth power of the radius. But then they noticed when the flow speed became larger, something was happening. And Osborne Reynolds was motivated by these experiments, and he wanted to figure out, on the one hand side, what exactly happened in pipe flow, and also to learn something about sort of the fundamental physics of the problem. And that's his apparatus. Very beautiful kind of thing. It still existed in Manchester until a little while ago, when they renovated their machine labs and sort of had to take it down. But Tom Mullen is working hard to get it back up, at least on display. It's a pipe of about 2 meter length. I've been told that of this original experiment, everything survived except the pipe, which was made of glass, and so they had to replace that by something else. So you have this pipe about 2 meters long, 2 centimeters diameter. There is a funnel in the inlet region to eliminate perturbations and to sort of get a very parallel flow entering the tube. You have a syringe through which you can inject some dye to visualize the flow, and then that's sort of the lever with which you start the whole thing going. And if you do at some intermediate Reynolds number, and you look at sort of this streak of dye going through, that's the kind of dynamics that you will get. Now this is sort of focusing on one section of this pipe, and the movie is looped, so it starts all over again. And what you notice is that sometimes, like now, it's sort of a straight line kind of thing, reflecting the laminar flow. And at some other times, it sort of has these turbulent bursts and that go through the thing. There is the color spreads over half the radius of the tube, sort of goes all over. Reynolds used spark lightning to look at the instantaneous flow profile and noticed in it already sort of vortices that mix in the radial direction. So what we would like to understand is what's the origin of these patterns. And for the theoretical calculation, we'll continuously loop the thing, meaning that we take periodic boundary conditions, so what sweeps out here will come back into the other side. That's a gross simplification of the problem. Ideally, the way you would do that in an experiment is that you take this and you put sort of your camera and you move it with the mean flow speed downstream so that you're watching one particular volume as it evolves, just to get rid of the advective aspects of the thing. Now, the problems that we have in understanding this is, to begin with, there is no linear instability. As far as I know, there is not sort of a rigorous mathematical proof, but if you calculate the eigenvalues up to Reynolds numbers 10 to the 7, they all have negative real parts, which means that they decay. No linear instability, and no linear instability means that you don't really have anything to develop Ginzburg-Landau type theories around. Then you have to go to finite amplitude perturbations. And finite amplitude perturbations imply that you sort of really have to deal with the nonlinearities in the system, which makes it nasty from a theoretical point of view. What's also worrisome is that there is a sensitive dependence on the type of perturbations that you add. As I'll explain in a minute, if you sort of set up an experiment where you induce a perturbation, and if you keep the experimental parameters fixed, and you repeat the experiment several times, the outcome are not clear. Meaning that in some cases you get turbulence and in other cases you decay.
Can you tell us in the theory, when you do the linear eigenvalue problem,
yes,
roughly how close to being zero are some of the eigenvalues?
About minus 1 over Reynolds number.
1 over Reynolds number. So obviously that's very weakly damped.
Oh yeah, but damped.
Frankly, non-normal.
And very strongly non-normal. But you see, all of this is within linear thing, and as soon as you start talking non-normal, you you're implying that the small amplitude approximation is no longer valid. Yeah, because the small perturbations can grow and...
Just distinguishing between short-term behavior and long-term behavior.
Okay. The point is, if you sort of invoke this non-normal concept, you have sort of a transient amplification. And the point I would make is that there is nothing else in phase space. Then you have a transient amplification, you have to go down. And this something else in phase space will come from nonlinear effects, which is what I mean when I say that the small amplitude approximation is no longer correct. More applicable.
It could be beyond after the experiment's finished, or it could be after it's got washed out of the pipe.
Yeah, but the system isn't quite that mean. It has nice structures to which it can hang on to, as I'll explain. The next observation is sort of from the attempt of modeling it. If you take structures or you look at flow situations that are translationally invariant in the downstream direction, they all decay. And what this means is that you really have to deal with three-dimensional flow fields and with sort of finite amplitude type things, which basically means you have to solve Navier-Stokes completely. And this is also suggested by the fact that these non-laminar states, whatever they are spatially and temporally complex. It's not sort of a simple pattern that sort of comes in. Okay, so here is then an experiment done by Dabiger and Mullen in 95, 10 years ago, that I found very revealing and stimulating. It's a pipe about 190 diameters long, where you can add a perturbation 70 diameters downstream. And since it's, as Tom puts it, it's the largest syringe in the world, meaning that he pulls it sort of at this end out, you know the mean flow speed with which it goes through. And therefore, you can sort of calculate and follow, if you add a perturbation here, when does it arrive at that end? And then you do a very simple coding. You introduce the perturbation. You know when it's going to reach the end, and then you simply color code your results, has it gone turbulent or not. And you do this as a function of Reynolds number one way, and as the determinant's amplitude the other way. Now for small Reynolds number and small disturbances, you're in the plural domain, where everything decays. Larger Reynolds number, larger perturbations, you're up there in the red domain, where everything goes turbulent. And if this were by any means sort of the traditional simple kind of bifurcations, you would hope to see a very clear separation between these two regions. And what you find instead is a somewhat messy type thing, where you have sort of this blue state up there, a decayed one, surrounded by lots of red states, meaning that if you change either Reynolds number or amplitude of perturbation a little bit, you can induce a transition or delay it. And similarly, down here, you have some red states surrounded by blue ones, indicating that, the final result, the outcome of these experiments, depends on details and the details of the perturbation.
How sensitive was it to the structure of the perturbation? I mean, if you put in a swirl rather than a flat curve, as it moves, axially symmetric to non-axially symmetric, is that coded here?
The way they put in the perturbation was by injecting fluids to a set of 3 or 6 nozzles from the side. And if I remember correctly, they tried several. There is another set of experiments being done in Delft with a different apparatus and a different type of perturbation. So the evidence seems that it's independent of the type of perturbation. And when we do our numerics, we take a very different kind of perturbation, and we reproduce basically this kind of behavior. What Mullen and Dabiger also did was to fix parameters. That is, you agree on a Reynolds number, and you agree on a disturbance amplitude, and then you still have a little variation from run to run, because the amount of fluid that enters is slightly different. And then what you find is you get sort of a probabilistic distribution of the result. Sometimes it goes turbulent, sometimes not. Meaning that these differences can be amplified. Now, if you do this in numerical simulation, and this is a low resolution one of about 40 by 40 points, you can do a little more. In this experiment, you basically looked at one point in time, which is, what is it, when it left, as to whether it was turbulent or not. In numerical simulation, what you can do is you can pick your initial conditions, and you can simply run it until it decays, or until you run out of patience, which in this case sort of had a limit of about 4,000 diameters, which is about 4 to 5 times longer than the longest pipe setup that exists. And so you pick a perturbation, and the shape of the perturbation is frozen. You have one parameter that controls the amplitude, and you have the Reynolds number. And so in that plane, you have sort of the Reynolds number and the amplitude as determining your the state that you want to study. And then you can assign to it a number, which is its lifetime. And this then gives you this landscape plot, again with the decaying ones here, with the turbulent ones up there. And what you notice is that this is a very rough type of landscape, meaning you have sort of a long-lived state here surrounded by short-lived ones. You have very long-lived ones here, again short-living ones around it. There is sort of this valley structure that reaches in there. Nothing like sort of a sharp transition or a gradual increase from the long-lived ones, short-lived ones up to the long-lived ones. It's sort of a very messy kind of thing. If you take in that kind of situation, and the best to get reproducible results is to forget about the details of the initial condition and to simply pick all the results that you get at one Reynolds number and collect lifetimes. And if you look at those lifetime statistics, then let's focus on this blue one here. What you can do is you repeat this 40, 50, 100 times, and then you see what kind of lifetimes you get. And then you can plot the probability that you're still turbulent after a certain time t. And then these are the data points. And then the straight line is sort of a fit to it. And since this is a logarithmic linear plot, this suggests an exponential. Now this is at one Reynolds number of about 2,000. As you increase the Reynolds number, the slope goes down, meaning that the mean lifetimes increase. And if you decrease the Reynolds number, you go the other way, and the thing sort of decays much more rapidly. So they're exponentially distributed, and therefore you can introduce a characteristic time. And if you plot those characteristic times, and I took the median of it, as a function of Reynolds number, you sort of get these dots, which increase very rapidly with Reynolds number. This down here is the linear estimate based on the normal kind of decay. And then the curious thing, if you plot the inverse median versus Reynolds number, all these points look like they might fall on a straight line. And with that straight line, you can extrapolate to zero, and that would be at about 2,250.
I'm sorry, these are numerical results or experimental?
Numerical.
I mean, Tom, I think, has similar measurements.
Right. Now, Tom, in the last year or so, has begun to do measurements for pipe flow. And I've seen data that support this exponential distribution. And he can do something like that, but I haven't seen the data and I haven't seen them evaluated. Now, there are data for a related kind of system, plane quad flow, where you have the, again, the probability versus the time, and this is now in real seconds. This is for different Reynolds numbers for plane quad flow from about 300 to 323. You again see the exponential distribution. And if you compare that, you can plot the inverse versus Reynolds number. Then you get these kinds of data. And these are numerical results from work with Armin Schmiegel and Holger Feist. And they're sort of in reasonably good agreement. The statistical scatter is quite large because at that time the computations were extremely time-consuming and we had only like 40 or 50 repetitions for each Reynolds number.
Has it been done for plane, for cell flow?
Interestingly, not that I know of. What I know of are experiments by Benzo Piva in Rome and his group that show the same sort of rough border between the decaying and the turbulent ones. But I haven't seen lifetime studies there. I do not expect much difference, because the Reynolds number regime is way below the one of the linear instability. And okay. There is an interesting consequence of these long lifetimes, because you can estimate that the dimension of the stable manifold of that turbulent set, if you have this, is something like the dimension of the space minus 1 over a Lyapunov exponent times this average time. And if this average time diverges, then this correction disappears, and the stable manifold of whatever structure you have approaches the full dimension. And the reason this is relevant is because this exponential decay suggests that the system, the phase-based structure that you're dealing with, is not one of an attractor, but rather of a chaotic saddle. And the idea with that is that you have some invariant things in there, like periodic orbits, that have to be unstable in order to give you the chaos. You're attracted along the stable manifold of them, and you run away along the unstable ones. And if there is only one of them, then that's the end of it. But if there are more, then maybe you leave one state and you're trapped by the other state, and then you sort of are shuffled around in phase space, and that's sort of what then gives you the lifetime. Now, at every transition element, you have a chance of escaping and falling back to the lambda, and this then gives you this exponential distribution in the lifetimes. And this is a kind of a picture what this looks like. So you have these red dots, which correspond to these unstable states, and then you have some arrows connecting them, which show you sort of how you move around. This is the energy of the perturbation. This is the mean shear rate. And then this here is where the turbulence is, the mean values from the turbulent one, including the fluctuation. And this is where you see all these connections happening. This is a very qualitative sketch. We don't have the same results for pipe flow yet. But that's sort of the picture that we have in mind for this transition. Now, in the previous picture, I showed you these points around which this turbulence then happens. And these points correspond to stationary states, or traveling waves, or periodic orbits. And the question is, how do you find them? And they are important when it comes to this thing, what is the turbulence in that system? Because if they're not there, the non-normal amplification only sort of gives you large amplitudes, but things have to decay. But once they appear, there will be manifolds with them, stable ones, attracting ones, and then you can see how sort of a non-normal amplification can push you over the limits and attract you to them. So the question is, how do you find these states in pipe flow? And this took us quite a while to do. If you've played with Newton-Raphson type methods in high dimensional spaces, you know that randomly selecting initial conditions, crossing your fingers in order to get there, won't do. And the idea how to go about it came from work that we did on Taylor-Cuett flow. Taylor-Cuett flow, as I showed, is the one between cylinders where you shear the fluid. And in the typical setup, it's dominated by the centrifugal instability because the curvature is large. But you can imagine a situation where, at least theoretically, you start changing the radius, the radii, to make them larger and larger, so that the curvature becomes less and less significant, and you move over to plane Cuett flow. So you can ask yourself, what happens to these bifurcations as I go over to plane Cuett flow? So this is the radius ratio going over this way. This is the plane Cuett flow limit. And then you notice that the instability for the Taylor vortices disappears. That's what it has to do, because plane Cuett flow is again stable. But the wavy vortices are much less affected by this change in parameters. They can drive themselves out of their wiggly three-dimensional behavior. And so their critical Reynolds number changes a little bit, but it reaches a finite limit when you get to plane Cuett flow. And that's the idea that we then use for pipe flow. You take the geometry of the pipe, You take the pressure gradient or the mean velocity to give you a parabolic profile, and then you add something that gives you something else. And then you hope that you get enough bifurcations and things that you can remove this additional driving to get back to the pipe flow. And since in all these flows, the dominant mechanism and process that happens has to do with vortices that mix across the shear, we started out with vortices. So we added the volume force that drove vortices mixing fluid from the walls to the center and from the center to the walls. And naturally, you can sort of take 6 as we did here, you can take 4, you can take 2, all kinds of things. The one with the 6 is nice because it gave us this beautiful structure here. And this beautiful structure is a traveling wave. So what is shown here, you see, if I start out here, all I have are velocities in the plane. It's a translationally invariant object downstream. And as far as the driving is concerned, there is no modulation in the downstream direction. So the arrows that you see here reflect, again, the velocity fields in that plane. The color coding is the modulation in the downstream direction relative to the parabola. The red parts here, this is where fluid from the center gets transported towards the wall. The fluid in the center moves faster, so when it gets to the wall, it has a surplus compared to the parabolic profile. These are the rapid, hot, red regions. And on the other hand, when you bring fluid from the wall to the center, it's slow from the wall and it hasn't been accelerated yet. So this is the low speed, cold, blue regions here. So that's what this mixing does. And as I said earlier, if it were two-dimensional, it wouldn't be enough. It has to have some three-dimensional structure to it. And this three-dimensional structure is such that it corresponds to a traveling wave. Meaning that if you let it run, and if you sit in one cross-section, as the wave sweeps through, you see this kind of dynamics happening.
This is an unstable solution that you found.
It happens to be unstable, but first of all, it's a solution.
Yes.
This machine is really getting old. There was a time when this was running faster. Anyway.
Are you able to capture with your numerics inflectional instabilities which would occur as the profile sort of gets bent? No, the mean profile, right? The cold fluid coming out will slow down the the parabolic profile and create inflection points.
For the time being, we haven't done this analysis for pipe flow. I mean, this goes along the lines of this modeling ideas of Fabian Valleffe that you
well,
have to put
back to Landau and all sorts of folks like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. What Valleffe did was piece these ideas together in order to get a self-sustaining mechanism.
But the question was, would your numerics be good enough to catch inflectional instability if they were to arise?
You have fixed on one wave length. You wouldn't probably resolve the very short waves. The computer allowed to select shortwave 1/100th of the main wave?
No.
Yeah, because that's quite important, surely, because that's sort of probably how you get these little spots and bursts occurring.
I'm not so sure. As far as the resolution issue is concerned, this is converged, meaning that there is nothing else happening. We have enough resolution to get friction factors and everything converged. So the issue of whether we need something that has 1/100th of a wavelength in radial or whatever direction doesn't seem to arise.
In axial direction, a short maximum.
Same game. I mean, if you add these perturbations, then they might do something. But as far as this flow is concerned for these structures, they're not there. The picture that has emerged, sort of how the dynamics of these things go, is that you have these vortices, and these vortices mix in the radial direction. And as they do, you can see you have sort of a gradient between the red and the blue region, which corresponds to a shear layer. That shear layer then develops an instability with vortices that go essentially in the radial direction. And now you recall that you have an overall shear on it, and therefore these vortices get pulled in the downstream direction, which brings them back to the vortices that you started out with. Now, of this process, the presence of the vortices themselves, they decay. The shear is built up by non-normal amplification. But once the shear layer reaches a certain strength, it goes linearly unstable. So, I mean, if you freeze the flow with that particular vortex shear layer structure, take that as sort of your initial condition, you get a linear instability. As your background profile, you get a linear instability. And this linear instability has the typical shear layer instabilities, and this gives you the vortices which you then pull down. That's the picture. And it's sort of present in here. We did some studies in a nine-dimensional model where you can really see the sequence of events for some periodic solutions, but not for others. As I said, you can start out with 6, which is what you just saw. You can take 4, you can take 8, you can take 10, and you sort of get more and more of these structures. Interestingly enough, if you know about non-normal amplification, 2 don't work. And the difference between 2 and 4 is that the 4 have basically a zero velocity in the center, whereas the 2 go right through the center. And that seems to make all the difference. The case with 2 vortices does not lead to a traveling wave. So if you put all of them together, Reynolds number one way, the typical friction factor that you like to plot in these cases, the other direction, this is the laminar profile, the green corresponds to some average turbulent profile that you would like to get, the black dots are data from Schlichting, this is from a numerical simulation at a somewhat lower Reynolds number, and so if you draw these things, that's the kind of pattern that you get, and then you notice that there is a point of bifurcation at about 1240, 1235.
What's the friction factor?
You assume that the force that you need to drive the thing is proportional to the velocity squared, and then there is an F in front of it. Well, so now we have these three-dimensional structures, and we can wave our hands that the tangle of their stable and unstable manifolds carries the turbulence. There was a question about the stability of these. These are the eigenvalues, real imaginary part. If you focus in on the small region, there is a neutral eigenvalue because it's a traveling wave, and there is one positive direction to go with it. And this positive direction is there in this particular system right from the bifurcation point. So you have to imagine it as a saddle node bifurcation on an unstable ridge. There is an unstable direction through which you can go down, and then you have a saddle node in that space that goes with it. Very interesting. All beautiful math. The question is, first of all, you see these traveling waves below the experimentally observed transition, and they're all unstable. So why bother? Now, this thing with them appearing below the observed turbulence transition is something that we haven't sorted out yet, fully. But the dynamical significance has been highlighted in experiments done in Delft, where Cas van Dorner set up a beautiful three-dimensional stereoscopic PIV system, where you have a cross-section of the pipe, and then you look with two cameras under plus minus 45 degrees, and then you can track three-dimensional positions, reconstruct three-dimensional positions of particles. And if you take two snapshots and you can correlate the particles in the flow, then you can get the three-dimensional velocity field that goes with that.
Mind is again the color coding.
I get that. So you can get all three velocity components, and it's the downstream component, which is sort of very fast, where you have large separations and then a high accuracy in determining the velocity field. And the span-wise one, the displacements are smaller and the velocities are smaller. That's where you have to struggle. But they managed. And then this is the types of cross-sections that they get. The blue regions are again the ones where the fluid is slower compared to a parabola of that mean speed. And the red regions is where it's faster in its downstream component. And the arrows are the in-plane velocity components, radial and azimuthal.
So this is a deviation from the parabolic profile.
It's the deviation from the parabolic profile with the same mean speed.
I thought these same people published a paper where they said that parabolic profile was distorted by the Coriolis force. In the lamina state.
Yes.
You don't have a parabolic profile.
I forgot how much that deviation was. I think it's smaller than what you see here.
Skewed.
Well,
maybe it's a deviation from that profile. I don't know.
No, this is, as far as I know, the deviation from the parabola, because we wanted to compare to our numerical simulations, and there we know that we don't have Coriolis forces and no deviations in the mean and so on. It would seem to me that the accuracy of the data isn't good enough to see that kind of difference. But, all right. So this is the kind of flow pattern that they got. The way you do the experiment is as before. You introduce a perturbation here, and then you watch it some distance downstream. And then, since this is a movie at a fixed position, you first have a laminar flow, then the perturbation arrives, does something, and then it decays. And this is one cross-section, and it's looped. And what you can still see are sort of these high-speed regions trapped somewhere close to the wall. You have, say, this wiggle here, and this wiggle is in its dynamics very reminiscent of what we saw in these six-fold states. And then you can extract from these cross-sections some coherent structures, and you can correlate what you see in these cross-sections to what you see in the experiment. Now, in order to go a little bit beyond this qualitative appearance, we introduced a detector and a projection from the full velocity field down to something nice and simple and easily interpreted, with an easy interpretation. Ideally, what we would like to do, because we want to see whether these coherent structures are in the flow. So ideally, what we would like to do is to really do a comparison between the three-dimensional velocity field and the traveling waves. We don't have enough data and not enough statistical evidence to go for it. So what we did was we introduced this kind of correlation function that takes the downstream velocity components and begins to look for these red spots. So you take a radius, that's fixed. You take a cross-section, that's also fixed. And then you average over the angle with the displacement. The velocity component at this position and the one at a displaced one, and this will give you a correlation function that depends only on that angle. Now, if you take a state where you don't sort of see a much prominent structure in there and you calculate this correlation function, it's of course large at zero and it's more or less flat sideways. And if you take one where you have these prominent streaks in there, you sort of get a very nice oscillation that is an indicator of the presence of some of these structures. Now, if you take this kind of indicator as a function of time, then what you will see is you have states where you have these vortices and states where they disappear, and then they come back up again and they disappear. So this is one with four of these correlated streaks. And if you now project this correlation function into something with a fourfold sinusoidal function, then it's the blue one. So it's large in this region where you would see these things. It's sort of flat here where they're basically gone. It goes large where they reappear here. If you take a different one, like this one here, where there is a kind of a six-fold structure in there, then the projection on n equals 6 goes large in the regions in which you see these structures. And with that, you can now sort of look at your time series and go through it probabilistically. So this is the time, and then you can assign, oh, this is dominated by regions with 3, and this by 4, and this has 6 vortices, 4 and 3, and so forth. And then you can look at the probability of finding these states. And there is sort of about a 30% fraction of all cross-sections that have significance from these states. And then you can go one step further and set up something like a Markov model to get the dynamics, the hopping events between these things. And if you take that and compare with the invariant densities that you see and if you get from the time series, which are the blue ones, and the ones from the Markov model, they're sort of in reasonably good agreement. So what this means is that these coherent structures and the dynamics that goes with them is not present permanently, but it sometimes appears and the system sort of hops through the state space with something that you can characterize in this projection with this kind of a Markov model. Now, ideally, in the long run, we would like to do this with all the individual traveling waves and periodic states because there we know exactly what we would like to get. It's one over determinant of the Jacobian as the weights, but that's sort of a tall order and sometime in the future. So we have to make do with this simplistic kind of approach to the whole thing. But I was quite pleased to see the good agreement between these probabilities from the time series and from this Markov model. Okay. Finally, let's come back to this issue of what is sort of the critical amplitude at which something happens. I showed you these experiments of Derbyshire and Mullin and the numerical simulations here, which indicate, I didn't show those. This is now from a low-dimensional model in which we could get this to very high resolution. This is again Reynolds number, amplitude of perturbation, blue is decaying, red is turbulent, and you see all these structures in there. But you can now ask yourself, is if the perturbation is small, since the flow is linearly stable, it must always decay. So if you start from the laminar profile and you go radially outwards in some direction, can you detect kind of like the first point where it goes unstable? And this point is sort of reasonably well defined. If I increase the amplitude of my perturbation and look at the lifetime, it's sort of flat down here, and then it goes up, and then it becomes wiggly, which comes from these fractal structures in there. If you magnify, then there is a little bump, but it then goes up very steeply. And this suggests that there is sort of a first point where this lifetime shoots through the roof and goes to infinity, which would correspond to you sitting on the stable manifold of something. And we wanted to get that something. So this is kind of the picture. If this is the amplitude of the perturbation and this is the lifetime crossing something like this now, you have these rapidly decaying regions like here, then you have the fractal stuff in between, and you would like to find sort of these points here which sit at the boundary between the chaotic and the laminar region. And we call those the edge of chaos, and the question is, how do you find it? And it's actually very simple. Suppose that you pick two amplitudes, one that is small and it drops off, and the other one that is large and swings up to the turbulence. Now you interpolate between those and you follow sort of, you try to find a pair where the lower one, well, eventually goes down, but it takes it a long time to do so, and the upper one swings up, but again, it takes it a long time to go up there. And then after a while, you have to refine. And you sort of know the distance, you pick a pair of points in between where again one goes up and the other one goes down. And if you do that for a very long time, what you can find is sort of this dashed line in between, which represents a trajectory that lives on the border between the decaying states that go to the lamina and the turbulent ones that swing up to the turbulent state. And we were sort of curious what this thing might be. It's the separatrix between the laminar state and the turbulent one. And this is what this looks like in a real simulation. You can see the differences between these points early on. They're kind of like 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. But then you see here A and B going up, and if you refine, then it comes a bit later, and if you refine more, it comes even later. But then you run out of resolution, and then you repeat the process, and you get kind of a pseudo trajectory. And so the question is, what does this trajectory that sort of stays in here and neither goes up nor goes down approach? What does it do? What does it look like? And the somewhat surprising result to us was that this trajectory approaches a single periodic orbit. There is a discrete symmetry in the system, which is why it's two of them, but all the states in that one symmetry approach this one orbit. This orbit happens to be somewhat complicated, but it's one orbit. It has one positively Lyapunov exponent, and that's the one that separates swinging up to turbulence and going down to the lamina. And since this was a nine-dimensional model, it has an eight-dimensional stable manifold. And this eight-dimensional stable manifold is the separatrix between the turbulent and the lamina. And we were quite pleased to see that it's sort of a reasonably simple object. We don't have to characterize the full manifold, but there is an invariant object in there, which is, in this case, a periodic orbit. What happened in this model is that by changing parameters, we could get to this kind of invariant object, which means that this periodic orbit underwent period doubling bifurcations and created some sort of chaos in that eight-dimensional manifold. So this edge state can be a bit more complicated. And just to indicate that you can use these ideas from this low-dimensional model also in the full pipe flow simulation, this is what we have for the moment. This is Reynolds number and energy of the critical state. And these are points where we detected this edge. And this has to be compared with the 1 over Reynolds number scaling that non-normal amplification predicts. And we're now in the process of sort of figuring out what the asymptotic state for that is. And that proves to be quite interesting. So, to sum up, what we've used are sort of nonlinear dynamical system ideas to come to grips with the phenomenology in pipe flow. What I think is important for the transition is, and crucial, is the appearance of these coherent states that come into existence at about 1230, 1240 in Reynolds number. They're transiently present in the simulations and in the experiments, just as they're sort of supposed to. And we can speculate that there are heteroclinic connections between them that give rise to the formation of a strange saddle. And the strongest evidence for that strange saddle is the exponential distribution of lifetimes that we see consistently in our numerics and for which there is now upcoming experimental evidence. And then finally, what we did recently is to identify sort of this edge of chaos as the stable manifold of some, in some cases, surprisingly simple states at the border. And we're now trying to characterize what these states are and to learn a little bit more about the transition in pipe flow from these things. Okay. And well, maybe to put this in perspective, since there was talk about sort of the other shear flows as well, the three prominent flows that fall into this category is pipe flow. This is what I talked about. There is plane coed flow, of which I showed only one example. And then there is plane Poiseuille flow. As far as linear stability is concerned, plane coed flow and pipe flow do not have an instability. And for plane Poiseuille, it's 5,000 something. But you see a transition at 1280 or 1500 or 1800. And in particular here, it's below this linear instability. Energy stability, which is sort of a monotonic decay of whatever perturbation you add in energy norm, gives you critical Reynolds numbers that are much too low. And now we know that there are stationary states in plane coed flow at about 500. I'm not aware of any stationary states in these systems. Probably they don't exist. And then you have traveling waves, which in this case would be periodic orbits starting at about 600. For plane Poiseuille flow, there are some calculations suggesting they come in at about 1,000. And for pipe flow, it's 1243. Now, there are other periodic solutions They certainly exist, but none of them have been found. There is one at a Reynolds number of about 1600, which is too high. And this is some of the literature in which we presented these kinds of ideas. Thank you very much.
Can you kind of remind us what Patera and Orszag did in?
It's the, this may be an oversimplification, but it's by and large a linear stability analysis of plane Poiseuille flow, followed by some linear, nonlinear analysis as suggesting that it's a subcritical bifurcation at 5-7 something.
They didn't identify any structures.
Not that I'm aware of. The first calculations of these states in plane Poiseuille flow come from the mid-90s by Koch and Ehrenstein. And in the last few years, Fabian has done a little more also on plane Poiseuille.
You anticipate that these structures will be much more or less the same for
yes.
all kinds of boundary layer vectors, those like in
by and large, yes.
ordinary boundary layer.
Yes. Well, when it comes to boundary layers, one has to be a bit careful. Very close to the walls, in the sort of sublayer, very close to the walls, it will be the downstream kind of things. If you move a bit further up, you have these Tolman-Schlichting waves, which come from vorticity, which is spanwise. That would be a different matter.
Can you follow this periodic orbit and say where it comes from? Or is it
out of nowhere. It's a saddle node bifurcation. It doesn't exist below, and at the point of bifurcation you have two. So in that sense, speaking of one was not fair.
Do the objects that you've identified, do they usually have one unstable direction, or is it
let's see, the six-fold one has one, and the others that come in at higher Reynolds numbers may have more, but I don't remember exactly. The key issue is they start out with one to begin with. This is a little bit different in plane Couette flow, where at the point of bifurcation, the Nagata-Busse-Cleva state is stable. In Reynolds numbers, in the usual notation, between about 125 and 128, and then it goes unstable. So there is a tiny interval in which it is stable. So in principle, you could see it. Nobody has so far, but. Whereas with these structures, they're immediately unstable. Everybody exhausted.
I was thinking about these traveling waves with the sort of six-fold or three-fold symmetry.
Yes.
That often occurs with sort of classic equations sorts of things. Lateral triangles fit together quite nicely. Are these strictly nonlinear solutions anything like in spatial structure? The least decaying linear moments?
No. The I'm not quite sure whether it's the least decaying, presumably it is. But for non-amplification, the most significant
the linear moments.
Yeah, yeah.
There are some very weak decaying things there, and years ago, 30 years ago, people looked at frequency wave number spectrum. Sort of found a mess, but it concentrates around dispersion relation of these weakly decaying solutions.
So the smallest numbers of vortices that you can fit in is two. And if you do a linear stability analysis, this is stable. And if you look at sort of the effectiveness of this state in drawing energy from the mean profile to build up shears, it's strongest. So for normal amplification, that's the most significant flow field. because it really goes through the center and really can build, draw on the full gradient. This state, as far as we can tell, up to Reynolds numbers 5,000, does not lead to a traveling wave. Now, with the other ones, they do look like sort of these patterns, but the main thing that is happening is, I think, if you sort of take a rim around the pipe, cut it open and stretch it out, then you're a little bit like in a plain grad flow type situation. You have a shear and you sort of want to set up these vortices. And then these vortices have an optimal wavelength, which is about sort of their width. And if you sort of try to put a few of them around the rim, as you increase that number, they have to get smaller in radial direction because they would like to sort of spread out your elbows and have sort of a certain width to go with it. And this is what determines the basic length scale in the structures that we see. Because if you go from 3 to 4 to 5 to 6, I mean, they get narrower and focus more on the walls.
And they can actually get to the center, and that means they prefer the lower wavelength.
But this may be
forcing them to be unnecessarily disciplined by being too fine a length scale.
Right, but the what then happens, I would be tempted to speculate, and you can see it in some of the figures. If you look at the mean profile, you have sort of a bunch of vortices at the walls that don't do anything in the center. What you then get is like a parabolic profile for the center on a smaller radius sitting on top of sort of a mean flow that comes from the wall. And you can imagine that this parabola then does something of its own. So the next level would be to consider staggered sets of vortices, some at the wall and some in the center, and you can go from there. There are lots of states like that. And they haven't been sort of described yet, but I have no doubt that they exist. At Reynolds numbers of about 2,000, that's the other thing. You see the bifurcation, the first bifurcation happens at about 1,200. That leaves plenty of room for other bifurcations until about 2,000 to start filling in phase space and putting up lots of these things. Now, one more thing on the experimental side. The data by Davischer and Mullen were lower in Reynolds number than many of the other data. I mean, they could get down to something like 1,800, whereas in most textbooks you will find 2,000 and sometimes even 2,500 as the critical Reynolds number. And there is an experiment in Marseille where they added particles to the flow. It changes the viscosity, but the main thing it does, I think, is to destroy the stability of the parabolic profile. And in those experiments, you can follow turbulence down to something like 1,300. And that suggests that there is something in phase space out there that occupies, say, a small volume in the normal Newtonian fluid, but sort of can be expanded if you add perturbations or suitable modifications of the flow.
If there are no more questions, let's thank Bruno.